Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. My favorite drive in all of California is Highway 395 from Walker to Lone Pine. Off to the west looms the incredible steep escarpment of the Sierra Nevada. Of the 12-14,000 foot peaks in California, 10 are in the Sierra. And up amongst them are beautiful granitic basins filled with streams, lakes, and ponds that have beckoned to explorers for thousands of years. Our guest is a man that knows the Sierra Nevada better than most, and best of all, he has the skills to explain the magic of the high country there. Kim Stanley Robinson has been called the greatest living science fiction writer in the world, with 22 published novels, including his brilliant Mars trilogy and his most recent novel, The Ministry for the Future, about climate change. But for me, his greatest work is his latest, and it isn't science fiction. The High Sierra, a Love Story, is part memoir, part human, and part natural history of the mountains that John Muir called the Range of Light. It's an absorbing and intimate voyage, not just through the Sierra, but also through the author's life. Robinson, Stan to his friends, joined us recently while staying with family in Maine to talk about the High Sierra and why people like he and I fall passionately in love with these sublime mountain landscapes. Stan Robinson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's good to be with you. And it was a huge pleasure to write that book, as you could probably tell.
Yes. And, you know, the subtitle is apt because it really is a love story. It's about your love of the High Sierra and the people in your life who shared that with you. It's wonderful. But I'd like to know, before we get too far along, when did you decide that you wanted to write a book about this part of your life? Because it's obviously very important to you.
Yes, it is important to me. I am a novelist. It isn't the first thing that occurred to me that I would write about the Sierras. So it really wasn't until COVID struck and I was also done with Ministry for the Future. Wasn't doing any travel, you know, shelter in place, and I was done with my novel contracts with my wonderful editor at Orbit Books. So I told him I wanted to take a break, write this book, and I did.
I'm so glad you did. There's so many things I love about this book, and it's an epic book, just like the High Sierra itself. So we definitely won't have time to talk about everything. For that, folks, read the book. But I want to ask you about your initial forays into the Sierra, because like me, you were a Southern California kid, and nature for you was probably, you know, the beach, going down, you know, body surfing, stuff like that, in Southern California. Tell us about when you first discovered the High Sierra.
Sure. It was a big moment. I was a beach kid. We lived about 10 miles from the beach in Orange County. We would go to Newport Beach, and I was a body surfer, and I loved it dearly. And I would say getting in the ocean and having an ocean life was my salvation as a suburban kid. And I was in Boy Scouts briefly, but it wasn't very satisfactory. And we went up to the scrubby Chaparral Mountains right there on the east side of Orange County, or behind it into the high desert. It was, to me, uninspiring. And I thought, well, I'm just not into that kind of thing, and focused on the beach. But we were undergraduates at UC San Diego. And when I say we, it was a group of friends, guys from Almedina High School. We all went down to UC San Diego together to body surf while we went to college. It was a good plan and we were enjoying it. And one of my closest friends, Terry Bear, came back from a Sierra trip and he said, guys, you got to see this. And I should explain the context. It was 1973. Mm-hmm. We had been 3 years of anti-Vietnam War protesters, total hippie stoner kids. For me, an intense interest in Buddhism and in literature and in poetry of Gary Snyder, you know, how to be a good Californian, how to be a Buddhist, all these Ram Dass, Aldous Huxley. We started taking acid. This was mostly a beach experience at first and kind of terrifying in that sense. But we went up to the Sierra Nevada with that kind of a mindset. And my friend Joe and I joined Terry. Terry was our fearless leader. And we took off into the desolation wilderness southwest of Tahoe, dropped some LSD about 100 yards up the trail. So my first day, I was flying, and Terry being Terry, we covered about 12 miles that day. Didn't stop until after sunset, almost full dark. And this was a kind of a Terry obsession. You don't want to stop too soon. You don't want to camp by other people. So I joke that I never came down from that day. And it's kind of true.
Yeah. And it was the moment when I started the book, when I said to myself, this book is for me, because it resonated so deeply with me. You've mentioned your friend Terry, and when you start to read the book, the foreshadowing is there that things are not going to end well for him. But throughout the book, he's woven through your story, and just your love for him as your friend and some of your frustrations together. It really does kind of tie the whole narrative together for me. And tell us a little bit about your friend Terry as a human being.
Sure, I will try. It's still hard. We met in sixth grade. It all had to do with sports. We were jocks, we were athletes. We did a lot of sports together. And this was casually on the side, as well as in intramural sports at UCSD, high school sports, et cetera. He was a true athlete, very intense, very high-spirited, humorous guy, and wanted to have fun, as we all did. So we were very close, and we roomed together our senior year of college, but we're next door neighbors, and our junior year. Essentially, we were high school friends who did college experience together. And then when I moved with a girlfriend to Davis, California, he was already there. And at that point, we were Sierra buddies as well. So a lifelong friend. And
sure.
So, you know, he was like a brother, and like a brother, there are good sides and bad sides to the bear, which is what we called him, his last name being bear in the German sense, Bayer. Mm-hmm. And the bear was a complicated guy, but I loved him like you loved a brother, and overlooked the increasing sense that he was getting mad at all of us, everybody. And I often thought, well, I'm never going to be included in that because we're such buds, but it wasn't true. And he essentially left all of us behind and said goodbye in a fit of anger about 10 years before he died. And I never saw him again. So in 2009, he took off, and it was a shocking thing, a sad thing. And I always hoped that we would reconcile, but another health problems struck him. So he really had bad luck in that way for an athlete, but it happens. And ALS got him, and he died in 2019.
Your love for him is woven throughout the book.
Yeah, thank you for that.
One of my favorite stories, and correct me if I'm not recalling this quite right, is you were trying to find him on the John Muir Trail. And searching for him because you knew he was up there, which is, you know, it's kind of like a needle in a haystack looking for somebody on trail like that in the Sierra. But you got up to a pass, and then as you're trying to interrogate some of the other hikers up there about it, you hear his voice. You know, Robinson, is that you?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I love that.
Yeah, you could not find a person in the Sierra by looking for him, but the John Muir Trail is very linear. I knew his habits. He had heard he was going to get a heart operation in 2 weeks. So he decided to hike the Muir Trail in case it was his last time. And I was away from town, or I would have gone with him from the start. And that would have been a thrasher. But in fact, I was away. I heard about it. His mom read me his schedule. I knew he had mistaken somehow how far he was going to go. I knew how far he was going to go. I picked a spot on the Muir Trail to intercept him, and I managed to do it. I cut him off at the pass, as I say in the book, and I was probably about, say, 3 or 4 hours ahead of where, if he had passed me, I never would have caught him from behind. But I cut him off with about 3 hours to spare, and so I was very satisfied with my detective work there.
Well, let's talk about the star of the show, which is the mountain range itself. And you eloquently make the case that there is no finer place on the planet to backpack than the High Sierra. And one of the wonderful things about the way you approach it, and you've mentioned it a little bit, I'd like you to go into that more, is that you love to go off trail. And there are a lot of mountain ranges and places and wilderness areas where that might not be a very good idea. But in the High Sierra, it's where the magic happens. Tell us about why and how you discovered going off trail and why that's so much fun for you.
Sure, and thank you for that. It's complicated. It takes a while to unpack this, but I'll give it a try. So the trails are like roads. You follow them. They're incised into the landscape. You don't have to do a whole lot of thinking. You just follow them. But if you get into a trailless area of wilderness, then you have to figure out what's the best way to go. Well, trailless wilderness in a lot of the mountain ranges of the world means that you're bushwhacking, means that you're in a gnarly temperate rainforest of one kind or another, and it's extremely difficult to see where you are or get anywhere. The High Sierra is a Mediterranean landscape at altitude such that it's mostly rock, and then there are some meadows, there are a few lower forests, but the rock is granite that has been burnished by glaciers. And so the way best to describe it is that it's actually a very high plateau, like between, say, 9,000 and 14,000 foot high. And it's been etched by glaciers, burnished by glaciers, but it hasn't been completely carved by glaciers in the way that a range like the Swiss Alps has been.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Goldilocks glaciation, where it's just right.
Yeah, that's right. It's not too much, it's not too little. And what you're left with is high basins, which is to say canyons, broad, open canyons that are maybe only 2,000 feet below the ridges surrounding them, rather than, say, 8,000 feet like in the Swiss Alps. And it, across those basins, you're sometimes walking as if you're on a giant sidewalk, a little bit lumpy, a little bit broken up, but nevertheless, easy walking. And then you come to a ridge that is bounding, usually a U-shaped ridge, like a horseshoe. And there will be places where you can get over the ridge into the next basin over. And those are passes, cross-country passes. And Sierra people, somewhat organized by the Sierra Club, but also independently and now online, have found all the easiest places to cross ridges from one basin to another. So these are named passes, and sometimes you can find some that aren't named, aren't identified, that are yours. You invented them, or you were the first to go over this spot on the ridge. If you're to do that now, you probably are doing something crazy and foolish, but that doesn't reduce the fun of it because it's yours. So crossing these ridges on class, we usually do class two passes. There are also class three passes. And
can you explain what those mean? Because I love your definition of between class two, which is fun and adventure, and class three, which is like, oh God, terrifying.
Yes, and that is a border you can see with you can feel with your body the difference between the two. And I guess the way to say it is on class two, you're using your hands to keep your balance and sometimes even pull yourself up a broken slope, but it's maybe about as steep as a staircase, not much more than that. And you're it's like a jungle gym, and you're monkeying up a slope using your hands, but trying to stay upright and just hiking up this slope or stepping up it. But your hands are there. And the thing is, if you were to slip and fall, you might break your ankle. And that's, you couldn't very easily kill yourself by falling on a class two slope. You'd basically slide down it. Sometimes it's just scree or even sandy decomposed granite. Other times it's small boulders. Other times it's gigantic boulders, which are scary but stable. But then class three, it's steeper and you're not likely to fall off. There's still holds. That's why it isn't class four or five. But if you were to fall, you could very possibly kill yourself. So at that point, you're talking about maybe a 50 or 60 degree angle of verticality. If 90 degrees was purely vertical, and if a staircase is 45 degrees, once you get to about 50, 60, and for sure 70, you don't want to be on that slope without maybe some rope protection. But climbers laugh at class three because they are so confident of their abilities, and they're usually roped up. And roping up is really for class four, class five. So when you're up there, most of the cross-country passes have been rated by the Sierra community through the decades, going right back to the early, maybe 1900s or 1910s. They began to use this system and develop it. It's a Sierra Club system that each part of the world tends to have a different rating system that they've developed, although they resemble each other. The one in the Sierras is, okay, you look for a class two pass, you're going to be able to do it, and you won't be too scared. It might be horrifically strenuous, but it won't be scary. It won't be dangerous. That's the difference. But then if you stray offline, or if somebody's miscalculated it, usually you, then you get onto a class three slope, and then suddenly you go from joy to fear. And so it's very easy to tell when you've crossed that border.
Yeah, and in your book, you definitely have some adventures, misadventures, where you get to that point where it's, uh-oh, this is not class two. This is getting on towards class three. And that's also, I don't know, part of the magic of it is figuring out how to negotiate these places for yourself.
Yep. Oh, it is. The navigational problems and the micro route finding of, okay, this way will go for me. I can hold on here. I won't fall off. Your focus, your sense of being in the present, it is absolute. And I suppose climbers experience this to the nth degree. And that's one of the reasons they're addicted to it. But for scramblers, and which is really what I'm describing as scrambling, it's the same kind of a thing. And when we have gone on to class three passages because we had to get where we wanted to go, or because we made a mistake, then I've often crawled on my belly. Usually on class three, I'm on my hands and knees. I'm moving only one limb at a time. I'm not actually comfortable. I'm thinking, there must be a better way. It's not as much fun as class two, where with class two, I'm like, this is such a great adventure. I'm finding my way through all of this rugged, ragged rock. And, 5-year-olds on a jungle gym, it's very much like that.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll stay in the Alpine Zone with our very special guest, author Kim Stanley Robinson, as we talk about the High Sierra. And we're back. Let's return now to our interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, author of the new book, The High Sierra, A Love Story. One of the really magic things about the High Sierra that I always enjoy is, and you described them as these just incredible little Zen gardens that look like they're manicured into the landscape up there. It's just so beautiful. It's hard to convey that in a lot of photography because you just see the stark kind of granitic landscape, which is also austere and beautiful in its own way. But there are these little tiny gardens of Eden up there that are just wonderful.
There sure are. I would call them meadows or fell fields, a technical term from ecologists, where the ground is more stone than it is plant. But usually well more, and the plants are scattered around in a sandy or rocky landscape, and it's amazing what can live up there. And of course, lichens are happy to live right on rock, and a lot of small alpine flowers are, it seems to me, their roots can grow right into gravel and get what they need. They don't need soil per se, but the more soil, the more it's like a meadow, the more you get grasses, the more you get other plants, and then their dead bodies provide the soil for a further expansion of these little gardens of Eden, these little Zen gardens. It was Gary Snyder who explained to me that Zen gardens are the Buddhist attempt in Japan to recreate at sea level what is typical of the Japanese Alps. So they were bringing high altitude down to low altitude, and that's why a Zen garden has sand and bonsai trees and all that. This is natural at high altitude. And there it's nature and the world that is the gardener rather than humans. Exquisite landscaping on the part of all the forces put together. You could hardly believe it. If a human had designed it, they would be universally praised as a great artist, but of course it's just what naturally happens up there.
Yeah, I've always had that feeling of when I'm in one of those spots, it's like, this is a perfect place and I never want to leave it.
Yeah, yeah. And you can camp in those. You come in about, I mean, to avoid the bear's mania and come in about 3 or 4 in the afternoon to give you some time to sit in it and look at it. Set a camp and you're in one of those glorious spots and the sunset will happen there and the dawn will happen there. And so just puttering about, making your tiny little home and eating meals and just sitting, especially after a day of walking all day, to sit there and look at everything with the light changing is, and you know, quite often there's weather, but hopefully it's not horrible weather and you can watch it and love it.
One of the things that I found really interesting is when your encounter, I think it's the first time you ever saw this, you get up to one of these high meadow passes and all of a sudden there are these glints of light out there and you're, you know, kind of wondering what they are and you discover what they are. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, what a glorious moment. We were sitting resting and we weren't far from the Muir Trail and we were on a giant lateral moraine of an ancient glacier that had disappeared. So it was a rock field, scree, sand, boulders, everything, all not a whole lot of plant. And it was late afternoon. We looked to the west and the hillside was sparkling like it was made of, like there were diamonds everywhere. And naturally we got up and wandered over to see what was going on. And it was shards of obsidian. So it was black glass, broken everywhere, all over the landscape, thousands of pieces of it. And we had either just before or just after, but no, it had to be before because we understood what we were seeing. Obsidian is not native to the High Sierra. There's none of it up there. If you see it, Native Americans brought it up there. Mm-hmm. So we were seeing a napping site. It might have been a casual party place for young people. It might have been a ceremonial site. But for sure, for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, people had sat there making blades out of obsidian and napping, as they call it. A big block of obsidian had to be carried there, and then blades were being knocked off of it by clever work with rocks.
Yeah, so they would haul the obsidian up there with the idea of, like, this is just this beautiful place in summer. Let's hang out here and make tools. I mean, sounds so perfect.
Yes, and you know, there are 3 or 4 big passes in the Sierra Crest where for sure indigenous people, our first peoples, our Native Americans, were going east to west, west to east. There are seashells in the Owens Valley. There's obsidian down in the Central Valley of California. And the Native American languages, Paiute on the east and Monash on the west, are mutually comprehensible dialects. And there are sites up in the high meadows, especially near Taboose Pass. I can speak confidently of that one, that was obviously a summer village for hundreds of years. And of course, it's screamingly hot in the Owens Valley and the Central Valley in the summer. And you get up to, this would be about 11,000 feet. And so you've got good temperatures, temperate climate. And there are a lot of signs that they lived there, including a few ovals of stone that were probably supporting wiki-up or willow shelters, temporary things, and a lot of obsidian everywhere, just thousands of pieces. So the place that we discovered, and it was, I thought it was our original discovery, the state archaeologist said, oh, this is somewhat away from the East-West Pass. I'm going to put it on my map. I found a map from 1927 where it was already marked. So it wasn't our original discovery. But in any case, that was about a 4-mile walk and more or less level away from that village site. So we postulate, and the archaeologists agreed that this was a subsidiary spot, a kind of a good looking, it was a lookout where you could see an immense stretch of land, the upper basin, the big canyon that starts the Kings River. And it was all very clear, very evident that these were humans. They were like us. They went to this spot because it looked good. It was a nice place to hang out. And so it was a very moving experience. That was about 2002. And it changed me yet again, where I thought I need to pay more attention to history, and not just European settler colonial history, but deep time history. Like, how long have people been up here, and what were they doing, and how did they live?
Well, let's talk a bit about, you've mentioned the John Muir Trail and the indigenous people that left those napping sites up there. Something that I really appreciated you did, and I hope you don't mind me asking you about this, was you come to the defense of John Muir, who is a hero to so many people who love the Sierra and the mountains of California and Alaska and the environmental movement. He's a very, you know, central figure, but he's been under a bit of attack in the last few years. And you make a quite eloquent case that might not be fair. Could you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes, and I'm happy to talk about it. I was thinking of myself as a kind of John Muir's defense lawyer for a year or so there, when he came under attack, even from the executive director of the Sierra Club. And it was all a kind of an internet, let's jump on the latest bad guy from the past. And there have been enough bad guys from the past that it isn't at all unlikely that a white European settler colonial, and in this case, an immigrant from Scotland, might be have had reprehensible theories and do bad things to Native Americans. It happened a lot, but Muir wasn't one of them. So he wrote maybe about 10,000 pages in his writing career, and in those 10,000 pages, there's about six or seven sentences that really do look quite ugly now, just saying nasty things about Native Americans. He was an abused child, Muir, by his father, who beat him mercilessly through his childhood and youth until he got away. And so he had a strange work ethic about work and cleanliness. If people were sitting around during the day, he was outraged. If people had any dirt on their clothing, he was offended. He would make remarks that sound ignorant and demeaning now, no doubt about it. But he also spent 3 months with the Tlingit people. He was filled with admiration for Native American culture. If you take on balance his complete writing about Native Americans, it's absolutely filled with admiration. And by 19th century standards, he was one of the great defenders of Native American culture. So that needed to be said. And I've said it, and I will stick by it. I think since that blow up of anti-Muir sentiment on the internet, some important people have come to his defense, including people of color who are active in the Sierra Club, who are perhaps better positioned to defend him than I am. And I'm happy to see that. I think the historical record is so clear that that bad moment will pass, and when the smoke clears, it will be seen that Muir was admirably aware of how advanced Native American cultures were to white Christian culture. And since his father was a preacher and was beating them out of some kind of Puritan madness, he said, it's really the Native Americans, the Tlingit in particular, who ought to be missionaries to the Christians.
Yeah, and I really appreciated that very much. Let's talk about the place that Muir loves so much, and you and I and so many people, the Sierra itself, because it's this wonderful range of mostly granite with this metamorphic cap rock here and there. Mm-hmm. But what I love about the Sierra granite is that it's not all the same granite. You know, it's not just like, oh, you've seen one granitic pass, you've seen them all. It's all different. It's kind of like granite is like soup that cooks down deep in the earth. And and it, you know, the recipes vary from from magma chamber to magma chamber. So it's all got its unique characteristics. And you talk about something you call psychogeology, I think it was.
Yes.
I love that. Tell us what psychogeology is.
Well, it seemed to me, there's this term psychogeography, which always made me laugh, because geography is always psycho in that geography is about the relationship of humans and their landscapes. So to say psychogeography is to be redundant. But geology is trying to talk about the rocks and how they formed and how the earth formed. You know what geology is. But psychogeology is, well, what does that do to you when you're up there in the mountains and you're hiking amongst bare rock? There are different psychological effects having to do with steepness and having to do with what you referred to, mineral composition. So that a lot of geologists will just scoff when you use the word granite. It's like what you said. It's like saying the word soup. And you're talking to a chef, and the chef is saying, well, soup, that's a pretty big term. Let's get specific here. And geologists get so specific about different kinds of granitic rock that they consider that word to be a layperson's word.
It's kind of like tomato soup, that you can throw all kinds of things into a tomato soup.
Yep. And the percentage of silica varies wildly. And the more silica, the whiter it is, the more feldspar and hornblende, the darker it is. And you certainly see giant divergences. Although the Sierra Nevada, well, this is something I describe in the book, the whole Sierra Nevada as a single raft of rock, that's a batholith. And then a batholith is made up of, in this case, about 30 plutons, which are individual bubbles of granite. When it's souping 10 miles underground, when it's hot and liquid, and then it cools underground, which is why it's granite instead of lava, which cools after it pops onto the surface.
That's why it had time to grow those wonderful crystals that make it so beautiful.
Exactly. Yes. And it turns into granite, and then it gets exposed to the surface much, much later. And then if it gets glaciated, what I say about granite is that it's friendly to humans. It's as smooth as a sidewalk in places, especially when glaciers have been on it. Also, it breaks up in staircase-like steps that are easy to step on, and those steps stick in their position. Now, one of the things that I will contrast that to, that Dave mentioned, these cap rocks of older metamorphic rock that were essentially the roof of the chamber of magma 10 miles underground, and those pieces of roofing never wore away. Whatever kind of rock they were previously, they melted by being in contact with the hot, soupy granite underground, and they turned into something different. What they were originally is often hard to tell. The metamorphic process was so intense. It's as hard as granite, and it's usually black or red, and it is not human friendly. It's like beds of nails. It's like clinkers. It's slippery. It wants to cut you. It's the plants that grow on it are more pokey. In short, the Sierra has a alien subranges lying on top of it of usually a blacker rock that is much more difficult to walk on and camp on. And I've had some bad encounters with metamorphic rock cutting me in ways that I couldn't stop the bleeding, so that I have a personal animus against the roof pendants of the Sierra Nevada. That said, the minarets, for instance, are a roof pendant, and there's nothing more gothic and spectacular in all of the Sierra than the minarets.
So many people will say, and I know you said this in the book, that, oh, that's their favorite part of the Sierra. But to me, and from reading your accounts, the real Sierra is what you call inside the Sierra, as opposed to outside. And could you talk a bit about that inside-outside relationship?
Yes. The Sierras are so tall, and the Central Valley and the Owens Valley are so much far below that when you're hiking in the Sierra, you can often see outside. So you're looking down, you see Bishop, California, Independence, you see Manzanar from above and see how big Manzanar was by looking at this old street plan. You're looking down 10,000 feet, and on certain parts of the crest, you can see the coastal range, you can see well into Nevada, and it's magnificent. But there's also many and many a place in the Sierra where you are surrounded by ridges And the exit from your basin drops into a canyon, and across that canyon is another ridge, and you cannot see out of the Sierra. So that I call being inside the Sierra.
Yeah.
And at that point, it could be the entire world. You can't tell. And the parts of the Sierra where you can see the outside are often magnificent in their own way. But there's something special about that feeling of being inside. And it's like you say, both Doozy Basin and Mitre Basin, and many basins are like this because they are like a horseshoe, and the open end is the only way you're going to see out because you're surrounded by ridges. Well, you, sometimes you can see out and you're seeing all the way to Nevada. Other times you see out and you're only seeing a wall 10 miles away of another basin that's facing you. So it depends what you're looking at the open end of a basin. But one could probably delineate on a map, like people have shown where the glaciers are in the Sierra. If you were intent to do it, you might have to ground check this. You could make a map showing what was inside and what was outside, but there wouldn't be much point to that, but it's a very distinct difference.
Well, you know it when you're there.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's right.
If you're just joining us, our guest is California-based science fiction author Kim Stanley Robinson, and we're talking about his latest book, which is a work of nonfiction, The High Sierra, A Love Story. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with the author of The High Sierra, A Love Story, Kim Stanley Robinson. You mentioned gear. Let's talk just a little bit about that, because one of the things that cracked me up was the picture of you carrying your Raichle hiking boots that weighed, I don't know how many pounds, I remember those kind of boots. Back in the 60s and 70s, that was like, oh, this is what you wear to backpacking. They were so heavy. And now, when you see people hiking and backpacking in the Sierra, I mean, they're wearing basically stout running shoes.
Yes. Well, that's all you need. Although everybody's different in terms of footwear, and I wouldn't want to prescribe anything. But for me, a strong sole underneath, very important. So it can't be actual running shoes. The rocks will make your feet hurt. And I have a tendency towards plantar fasciitis, so I need a strong sole. Up top, you don't need much of anything. And indeed, those monsters with their super high, almost calf high tops to them, when you really do twist your ankle, that big shoe isn't going to help you. So it was always wasted weight.
Yeah.
But beyond the shoes, there are people who are hiking from Mexico to Canada in a single season. Through hikers, they're called. They do the Pacific Crest Trail, the Continental Trail, the Appalachian Trail.
And the Muir Trail is part of it.
The Muir Trail is part of the Pacific Crest Trail. So the Muir Trail is 220 miles or 212 miles, and the Pacific Crest Trail is 2,560 miles. So the Muir Trail is a rather short portion of the Pacific Crest Trail, although I think it's the best part. But I don't know, because I haven't done the Pacific Crest Trail and I have no desire to. But those people have driven an industry, which is mostly a cottage industry of small manufacturers who are selling the lightest gear they can make to do the job. And they're using new materials that my friend Terry never got introduced to, Dyneema being the name of a kind of fabric that was made for America Cup racing yachts for sail material. Well, that material is excellent for backpacks, for tarps, for perhaps even clothing, I don't know, but for sure backpacks and tarps. It's stronger, lighter, more waterproof. And that's happening all across the board. There's an arms race amongst these small cottage industries. Can you make something that's comfortable, that's even lighter than the competitors? And since they're mostly online industries, people who spend their winters planning their next campaign on the Pacific Crest Trail are fanatical about it. Well, those of us who are older, less ambitious to cover miles, we are the beneficiaries of these people's ambitions. And the industry that's popped up in terms of material science. My backpack went before I put the food in it, but I'm ready to go for a summertime in the Sierra and maybe even early fall. The total weight will be something like 8 pounds. And there used to be 8-pound backpacks, which is to say just the bag or an eight-pound tent. And now everything that I need adds to 8 pounds. So at that point, as Terry said, and he might have got this somewhere else, but he certainly insisted on it, when your weight on your back is 10% of your body weight or less, you don't notice it, it doesn't impact you, you're having fun, it's almost forgotten. And so you can do that now, and it's very wonderful.
Yeah, and it also can prolong your hiking life as we get older, you know, in our 60s and 70s. You can still do it because you don't have to be dragging 45, 50 pounds up there.
Yes, yes. And the other additional point here is that walking poles are fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody uses them up there. And I started in 99 because I saw that Reinhold Messner was hiking into one of his fantastic Himalayan climbs using walking poles. I thought, if it's good enough for Messner, it's good enough for me. I started using them then. And they have a dual use. They serve as your tent poles at night. But when you hike with them, you distribute the effort across your whole body, occasionally save yourself from a fall, but it's more the distribution of effort that means that, I hit 70 this year. I would like to backpack a few to several more years in the same style that I always have of cross country, of doing some challenging things. Well, that's only going to last a while longer given the way that we used to thrash. But the longer the better. And it is a gear revolution that's making it possible, because I hike with younger friends who don't bother with it. At least I have recently. These are guys in their early 40s and they're still carrying 35 pounds on their back. I can barely lift their backpacks, which I know I used to in my youth, but now I can't. So this, it's not just a finicky thing or it's more an enabling device that as you age out, the lightweight is becoming a crucial enabler.
Just like those heavy boots back then, you were more likely to twist your ankle because your damn legs were so tired.
Yep. I still keep those. I should bronze them or something.
Yeah. But
no, it's too depressing. As I said in the book, I carry those boots more miles than I wore them.
A couple of last questions for you. What about your family? I know your wife, you met her in Davis, right?
Yes.
And she was a swimmer, as I recall. And do you guys backpack together still?
We do. We were just up there, I guess it was last month, the beginning of July. And there we tried something, because she has a pinched nerve in her neck, can't carry a backpack. Mm. We hired a horse packer out of Bishop, California.
Okay. Yeah, I used to do that.
Bishop Pack Company, yes. And they took up with two other couples. We went up there and we walked in, and she can walk forever still, which is great. And the packers took in about 500 pounds of gear. So this was not ultralight. In fact, it was
That's glamping.
Yes, it was. We laughed our heads off because we brought more than needed, because we didn't know what we needed or not, because we don't know what glamping is at this point. But there we were in Humphreys Base and base camped for 4 days, and the campers came back at the end of it and hauled it back out. And my wife did fine. She loved it. And my boys, as I described in the book, we had a group of people in Village Homes, part of Davis, that went up there with the little squeaker kids and set a base camp in Desolation, or moved. You know, we would pack everything up, would move a half mile or a mile and set up at another little pond, to give the feeling of backpacking without the immense work of the Southern Sierra. So yes, family has been part of it and been a joyous part of it. But the big thrasher trips in the Southern Sierra have an epic quality that has been mostly me and my buds. And I will say this, the Kings Canyon Sequoia cannot be seen by people from cars. The road system isn't extensive enough, and that was a conscious choice by the National Park Superintendent of the 40s, John White. And so Yosemite gives people a sense of what the Sierras are like. And Yosemite, of course, is one of the most visited national parks, one of the most famous places on the planet. You only go 100 miles south, and here's this even more magnificent backcountry that nobody knows about, because you have to walk your brains out to get there and look at it. And I like that.
But it's so worth it when you
get, because
it's so beautiful. And you use a word that I love, this word sublime, that really does capture what it's like to be in those high lonesome places.
Yep. Well, it does. I would argue you can't quite capture it in words. So I tried my best. I have to confess.
Or photographs.
Yeah, photographs don't do it either because scales are thrown off. And besides, I'm an amateur and so are my friends. And it's a 360, it's a spatial experience, it's a spiritual experience. And when you say the inexpressible, that captures an aspect of it that's very important, but you can't then say that you've expressed it. You've only expressed the fact that you can't express it and that you have to experience it. And I suppose there's quite a few experiences like that in life. Language is good, but it isn't all powerful. So the Sierra is a particular experience. And I've been getting letters from, and these are letters in the mail, not emails, of people who are Sierra people. And they're saying to me, yeah, it's like that. I know what you mean. You know, even if this book is only what people can say, and there's a lot that you can't say, they get it. And because they've felt it.
Before I let you go, you've written a lot about climate change. And in the book, you know, sadly, we have to address that too. Talk just a little bit about some of the changes that you have seen wrought in your beloved High Sierra, especially in the last, say, 20, 30 years.
Sure. It has been sometimes a really painful shock to see, well, the glaciers, which in the Sierras were quite small, are going away. And then desiccation of drought, and then occasionally incredibly smoky air, which of course passes, but it's a sign that things are burning on the western slope.
Oh, yeah.
But the main thing I guess I would say in terms of shock is drought, that hiking in September is sometimes you feel like the whole landscape has died. The creeks aren't running. They're just black streaks on the ground. And I've never—
The lakes have shrunk.
Yeah, they shrunk, and some of the smallest ponds are just, especially if they're perched so that they don't get much that year's snow, is what keeps these little ponds going. And if there isn't much snow, those ponds will turn into dry pads for the late fall. And then I write about this in the book. In September of 2021, we went up to the head of Dead Man Canyon. The head of it faces north. So underneath the cliff wall at the top of that canyon were seven small glaciers. They're on the topo map still. Only a third of one was still there. And the rest was dry bone rock. So that there was no question that those glaciers were gone, because you could see right down to the dust and dirt because there was no snow. Well, this was shocking. We had actually seen all these glaciers in, say, 2003 or seven. And so in the last 15 years, those little glaciers have melted away. And the one that was still there was melting right in front of our eyes. We could hear it all that night because it never gets below freezing at night in the summer there. So quickly, even the Palisades Glacier, the biggest one, will soon be gone, and we will have a glacierless Sierra.
It's so dry. It's hard. But the Sierra is also very resilient.
Yes, I came out of that trip in a kind of despair, and I was thinking, the world is doomed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was just such a shock. But friends of mine who know more, ecologists or Sierra people, national park people, they said, especially Mondo Quintero, a good friend who is now head of California State Parks, but he was a national park ranger and a Sequoia guy. He said, look, the High Sierra have experienced 100-year droughts in the past since the Ice Age. And we know this for sure from tree rings. And what you see up there is what you get after a 100-year drought is over. In short, these are extremophiles. And this is a landscape that is used to droughts, and it comes back. And so it will suffer, but you don't have to think about the whole thing turning into a moonscape or a Mars range, or even, you know, the eastern side of Nevada or the Basin and Range. It's going to get some rain from the Pacific. It's so high. It's so close to the Pacific. It'll get some moisture. Things will adjust. We'll survive. And we all have to work for a better time. Essentially, the High Sierra is like the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about the Sierra or the last scenario, you have to understand that everybody else on Earth is worried about their area too, because it's all getting hammered.
Yeah.
So that gave me some comfort. That put everything in perspective. And so, yeah, well, we all got to work on it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us to talk about this fantastic book, The High Sierra, A Love Story, and for, you know, also remembering your friend Terry Bear. I want you to know that meant a lot to me as I read that book. Your love for him came through very strongly, and it was very moving.
I appreciate that so much.
Thanks again to our guest, author, and mountain explorer extraordinaire, Kim Stanley Robinson. His latest book, one of my favorite reads in years, is The High Sierra, A Love Story. It's published by Little Brown & Company and available at most booksellers. I hope that you, if you're in reasonably good health and have a love of adventure and nature, spend some time rambling and scrambling in the High Sierra. But beware, you too might fall under the spell of this magnificent mountain range, and for the rest of your life, you will long to be in those sublime high-altitude places that are as perfect a place as you could hope to find on our Blue Dot in the cosmos. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. The theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.